Hello, everyone. I'm joined here with Chuck Baldwin. He was the Constitution Party nominee for president in 2008. Welcome to my show. So you recently, you were the pastor at the Crossroads Baptist Church in Pensacola, Florida, and you recently left to move to Montana.
We got here in 2010, so we've been here right about 2 years.
So could you talk about some of your reasons for moving to Montana?
It was a result of about a three-year in-depth research and contemplation by my family and I. We're talking about five families. It would be myself and my wife, our three grown children and their families, and then my mother and father-in-law. So it was an arduous process, actually, of prayerful research and investigation as to where we were going to move to. We knew that we would be leaving Florida at some point. We did not know exactly when, and we certainly didn't know where we would go. So we just took a lot of time to consider it, study it, research it. And after all of that, we finally settled on the Flathead Valley of Montana, and that's where we've been for the last 2 years.
Were there political reasons for moving? There's a sort of a political movement in Montana. There's different ones, but like Patriot Movement, for instance, was that a factor?
Well, I don't know if I would put it in those terms. During the course of 2008 and 2009, I traveled over 100,000 miles across the continental United States, and I had the opportunity to speak up here in this region of Montana about three different times, if I recall correctly. And each time that I was here, I observed a spirit of liberty among the people that I had not experienced anywhere else in the country. And so was a factor, the spirit of freedom, the way the people here love liberty and independence, you know, that was certainly a factor.
Recently, you wrote about Rand Paul's endorsement for Mitt Romney.
Yes, I did.
I know a lot of Ron Paul supporters they're very, very disappointed in Rand Paul.
And I would put myself in that group as well.
So did you have some reserves about Rand Paul before this happened, or were you surprised by this or not at all?
Well, I've never met Rand personally except one time. And I guess to express my feelings before his endorsement of Mitt Romney, I would simply say that I was optimistic that he would be a senator in the similitude of his dad, Ron Paul. And I was very, very disappointed when he came out the way he did in support of Mitt Romney. And I think as a result of that, as I said in my column, I think Rand has forfeited the leadership for the patriot-loving, freedom-loving folks of America that many of us had hoped that he would have. Obviously, in my opinion, Rand Paul does not have the same leadership capability and convictions of his dad.
I guess there's different reasonings for doing so. I think part of it is because because he's a Republican senator, he's also under a lot of pressure from the Republican leadership. But I also think he's gearing up for maybe running for president in 2016, and he knows that if he didn't endorse Mitt Romney, that the Republicans would really give him a hard time for it. So I think he's looking out for his personal political career, but at the same time selling out a principle.
Well, I think we all understand the reasons why he did it. I don't think there's any question that he's posturing for the future. But again, you know, his dad has run for president three times. He's never compromised He's never capitulated. He's always chosen to remain true to his convictions. And that's why he is the man that he is. It's why he has the star quality that he has. It's why he has obtained such a huge following across the country. And, you know, Ron Paul, in my opinion, is the greatest congressman in the history of the United States of America. I'm on record as saying that many times. I think history will prove that my assessment is accurate. I think Ron Paul has started a movement, if you want to call it. I think he has lit a fire of liberty in the hearts and minds of millions of Americans across the country that's never going to go out.
One thing that's important to point out, Ron Paul endorsed you when you ran for president.
Yes, that's correct. He did in 2008. He refused to endorse John McCain for the same reasons that, in my opinion, Rand Paul should have refused to endorse Mitt Romney.
So you point out that we lost more liberties under Bush than we did under Clinton, and you make the case, obviously, a lot of people say that John McCain and Barack Obama would be equally bad, but you even go as far as to say that McCain would be even worse.
I think anytime you put a neocon Republican in the White House who is controlled by the powers that be, who does not have the grit and the conviction to resist the globalist machinations of the people that influence both political parties at that level, we're going to lose more ground than we would if a Democrat were in office. And the reason for that is not because the Republican is any worse than the Democrat, personally, but the reason is the people that would resist those kind of machinations go to sleep. They just roll over and go to sleep. When Bill Clinton was in office, we had an active, energized Republican Party at the conservative base. We had an active, energized patriot community. We had an active, energized independent movement. You know, a lot of things that Bill Clinton and Al Gore may have wanted to have done, they were not able to do because of the opposition that they had on Capitol Hill and in grassroots America. Fast forward to 2000, whenever G.W. Bush took office, 2001, and we had 8 years of the conservative / Christian / evangelical / religious right folks just going sound asleep. Everything that we saw happen under G.W. Bush, most of the things that happened to G.W. Bush would not have happened if we had had a Democrat in office. So you put a Mitt Romney in office, and you're going to have more of the same without the opposition.
You're absolutely right, because you look how the Republicans in Congress are going after Obama. I mean, if Romney did a lot of the same things, they would be completely silent. And you saw that with the Tea Party, and the Tea Party came about because of Obama, but a lot of those same people in the Tea Party were silent when George Bush did all the same things that Obama's doing, like the loss of liberties and the growing the size of government and amnesty and all that.
Yeah, there's no question about it. That's why we never gain any ground whenever we put one of these neocon Republicans in the White House. So to endorse somebody like Mitt Romney for the sake of political posturing is just more of the same. It's the kind of reasoning and the kind of strategy that got us in the mess that we're in. You know, this compromise with the powers that be, the compromise with the establishment party structure of either party has what got us where we are. And that's where Ron Paul shines. You know, Ron Paul has just said, I'm not going to compromise. I'm going to be faithful to my oath of office. I'm going to support the Constitution. I'm not going to go along with this establishment party line just for the sake of partisanship. I'm going to put my flag on the ground, on the hill of liberty, and just see what happens. And that's what he's done. And, you know, it's now he's retiring from Congress. So who is going to be our voice on Capitol Hill? Well, obviously it's not going to be Rand Paul. He's made it very clear that he is going to do whatever it takes to try to ingratiate himself to the power elite. So who is going to be our voice on Capitol Hill now that Ron Paul is retiring? And I think, to me, this is the saddest part of this whole election cycle, is the fact that we're losing, not only losing Ron Paul as the nominee of the Republican Party, but we're also losing him as the stellar congressman from Texas who's been our voice on Capitol Hill for 2.5 decades.
Would you also say that on Rand Paul's voting records, has he also compromised his principles on his voting record?
Most of his voting record that I've observed has been good. I'm not sure what you're referring to. I might could find something here or there. But the voting record that I've observed on Rand has been good. So I'm now criticizing his voting record. But, you know, when you're talking about being the leader of a freedom movement, which is what Ron Paul has been, it's more than a voting record. There are probably 50 or 60 congressmen and maybe a half a dozen or a dozen senators that we could point to and, you know, talk in glowing terms about their voting record. But none of them is the leader of a freedom movement in America. Not one of them. Not one of the men that we would say, okay, now this is a good voting record. Not one of them could you say, all right, we're going to have a rally in Los Angeles, California this Saturday and have, 5,000 people show up, and some of them drive for hundreds of miles to get there and pay money that they barely have, to the expenses involved, to be there and cheer this man on and let everybody know that they're supporting him. There's no one else on that has that kind of magnetism. And Ron Paul did not get that kind of magnetism on his voting record alone. He got that on his leader, but he got that by, whenever he stood up, for example, earlier in the primary season, and had that debate in, I think it was South Carolina, and talked about the result of our stupid foreign policy and how that we are creating more enemies than we are friends. And he talked about blowback and what that means. And Rudy Giuliani, you remember this, Robert, Rudy Giuliani tried to do everything he could to embarrass him. He tried to make him back up. He tried to use this phony patriotism against him, and you got to apologize for that. And at that moment, the entire patriot community was if you could, we're holding our breath, and knowing what Ron was going to do. Ron didn't back up one bit. He stood his ground, and that's what Ron has been doing for 24 years. And that's what I'm saying. Rand's got a good voting record, and there's a few dozen congressmen that've got a good voting record, and there's probably a dozen senators or more that have got a good voting record. But not one of them has that kind of character and courage of leadership. And that was the kind of courage that we were hoping that Rand would bring to the table, but obviously he does not.
What are your thoughts on the third-party candidates running this election?
I'm always in favor of third parties running. I think that third parties provide an alternative for a lot of people to express themselves politically, because there's hundreds of thousands and millions of people across the country that have just they're fed up with the lesser of two evils. And they're not going to go into the voting booth and vote for the lesser of two evils. They're just not going to do it. So either they're going to stay home and not vote at all, or they're going to write in a protest vote just for the sheer sake of doing it, or they're going to vote for a third-party candidate. So whether the third-party candidate wins or not isn't the issue. That candidate gives people, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, an alternative from the two-party lesser of two evils that they keep presenting for us every 4 years. Now, I would like to think that the day would come that we could put up a formidable third-party candidate that would actually win and break the back of this two-party stranglehold that we have in America. But until that day, at least we do have an option when a third-party candidate runs. I think we need more of them.
A lot of people are saying that we can't vote our way out of this mess at the ballot box. Do you agree with that?
Well, by saying we can't, obviously I don't agree with that because we can. We do have the ballot box, and if enough of the American people would use the ballot box as they should, then of course we can. The question is not can we, the question is will we?
Yeah, that is the thing. Most people just vote for the lesser of two evils, even though they know, even people who know that they're both candidates are bad, so they're really kind of, that mentality is a part of the problem. But then there's other issues. There's also voter fraud. Even if people do decide to vote in principle, there's like voter fraud, especially with electronic voting.
Yeah, I hear reports of that, Bob, every once in a while. I don't know personally how widespread it is. I do have questions in my own mind about how widespread it is. But I think the biggest problem we have is just what you said a minute ago. Most people are willing to vote for the lesser of two evils. Most people either are not informed, as they should be, or are unwilling to be informed. Whatever the case may be, they just seem to be content to allow the status quo to continue by voting for these establishment politicians from both parties.
So you have a list of candidates that you endorse. Your son, who's a constitutional attorney, is running for Congress in Montana.
That's correct.
Is that with the Constitution Party?
No, he's running as a Republican.
So you have several different candidates you endorsed. I think one of them, I just interviewed, do you know Thomas Blemming in Wyoming? I recently interviewed him.
You know, I have heard that name, but no, I do not know him, and I've never spoken with him, but I believe other people have told me about him, and now you are, again, bringing his name to my attention. So I'm glad to hear that. I know that there are men and women around the country that are, you know, running for state office that really deserve the support of the people in their districts. You know, Robert, I really believe that freedom is going to be won or lost at the state level anyway. When you really stop and think about it, it doesn't matter to a hill of beans what the Supreme Court says or what the president does or Congress does. Each state has the constitutional authority to reject and resist whatever the machinations of Washington, D.C. might be. And if we lose whatever the liberties are that we would lose, it will be because of our state governors and our attorney generals and our legislatures and our state judges going along with and capitulating to the unconstitutional usurpations of power by Washington, D.C. So at the end of the day, it's going to be more important who we elect at the state level than it is who we elect at the federal level. And if we can only get people to understand that and support these great constitutionalists in their respective states and districts, liberty could be preserved just by doing that.
Yeah, the system on the federal level is just way too corrupt, really, to reform. But if the local level is taken back, then they can put in a sort of a good fight.
Well, not just a good fight. They have the constitutional authority to refuse to cooperate with Washington, D.C. The states are granted constitutionally the ultimate check and balance to Washington, D.C. You know, Obamacare, for example. You know, we're all mucho upset with John Roberts for what he did to us.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm not surprised at all. Look at all the judges that have been appointed by Republicans.
Sure. Well, most of them over the last 30 years, the Republican Party has held a majority on the Supreme Court going back to the 1960s. So you're exactly right. But my point is that, you know, while we're disappointed about Roberts on the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, look what the state of Virginia legislature and governor has said, you know, we are not going to comply with Obamacare here in the state of Virginia. And that's something that every state in the union could do. So, I mean, if people that are really upset about Obamacare and are upset about what's happened at the federal level, okay, that's fine. You still have a state government, independent, sovereign state, which is what the Declaration of Independence says, and that state has the authority under God to resist and refuse to cooperate with unconstitutional mandates from Washington, D.C. So ultimately, liberty is going to be won or lost at the state level.
So one of the articles you have is what many churches and the SPLC have in common.
Well, of course, the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, is an ultra-liberal establishment, big government organization that revels in trying to impugn and denigrate anyone who categorizes himself as a constitutionalist. People that will identify with the Founding Fathers and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence will express those sentiments in the public debate today are categorized as extremists and radicals, etc., by the SPLC. And the point of the column that I wrote there was that, unfortunately, many of your establishment 501c3 churches today more or less do the same thing. They will impugn or denigrate any Christian who refuses to go along with the New World Order or who refuses to go along with this 501c3 corrupt government status for churches, who take a stand for the principles of liberty and freedom and will teach those principles as they are presented in the Bible. They will look askance and so forth at such Christians. So in doing so, they've aligned themselves with these ultra-radical liberal groups such as the SPLC.
The thing about it, I mean, the religious right has been one of the biggest sort of enablers of the whole sort of neocon agenda.
That's correct. And that's an evolution that took place over the last 20 years or so. It didn't really start out that way. I was there when the so-called religious right was born. I was the executive director of the Florida Moral Majority, serving with Dr. Jerry Falwell, who was my mentor. I'm a graduate of Liberty University, first graduating class, by the way, 1975. He and I were pretty good friends for, well, most of our life after that, until he passed away. And, you know, so I was there at the formation of the Moral Majority, the Religious Right, the Christian Coalition, all of those religious movements that began in the late 70s and early. And it really did kind of start out very similarly to the Tea Parties. You know, at that point, it was a very strong, principled movement that was concerned about the loss of our liberty. Of course, they were concerned about the abortion issue and some of the moral issues domestically. But they were also concerned about, you know, what was happening at the federal level in terms of the corruption of our political system and the establishment GOP and how they were facilitating big government, et cetera. You know, so it started out in a very healthy manner. But over the last 20 years or so, it has degenerated into, as you said, nothing more than an enabler for the big government neocon agenda.
And what do you see as some of the reasonings for that? Do you think one of the factors is sort of the Christian Zionist movement, which especially supports the neocon foreign policy in the Middle East.
Yes, that's a big problem. That's a big problem. But the other problem is, I hate to be so cynical, Robert, but another big problem is self-aggrandizement. You know, I remember when Gary Bauer said back in the early 80s, and I was there in D.C. when he said it, all we want is a seat at the table. Well, what he meant by that is, well, all we want to be on the inside. You know, we want to be invited to the parties. We want to be, made privy to the private discussions. We want the personal phone calls. We want what the insiders have, and we want that. Well, they got it. After the election of Ronald Reagan, the religious right was brought into the, if you want to say, the inside or the establishment side of D.C. And a lot of those leaders became part of that power structure, or at least at some level. And, you know, once you get a taste of that, you don't want to let it go. It's a perk. It's a not to mention a tremendous boost to your profession, your career, your monetary standing, your future, etc. To let that go is something you don't want to do. I mean, that's what these elections are all about between the Democrats and the Republicans. It's nothing to do with principles. Has nothing to do with issues. It's all about power. It's all about one party wanting power, and when the other party has it, they want to get it. And whenever the other party has it, I mean, when the other party doesn't have it, they want to keep them from having it. About power and everything that power provides. So, you know, I think that whenever the religious right became an influential part of the inner circle, if you want to call it that, of the power establishment in Washington, D.C., they became enamored with that. They loved their place at the table, and they didn't want to let it go. And I think that is driving as much of this as anything else. And I know that's a base reason, but, you know, I hate to say it, but I was there. I saw it myself personally from the inside, and I think that's pretty much what's driving a lot of this.
And the rank and file members of the religious right, they're complacent as well with all this.
I think, yeah, they're complacent. I think they're misguided. A lot of them are not complacent. A lot of them are active. You know, they raise money. They get involved in organizations. They work hard. They go to meetings. They pay money out of their pocket to try to make a difference. But they're misguided. The religious leaders, the guys that are on the television and the radio shows, they're the ones that are putting out the letters in the mail drops, and they're the ones that. They're the voices that people listen to. They are the ones who are guiding and directing the grassroots conservative Christians into this big government neocon agenda. And yes, the Christian Zionist movement is a part of that. So I think many of the grassroots, they've got good hearts. They really love their country, and they do love freedom, and they want to do the right thing, but they're following the leaders of these movements that for the most part that do not share the principled agenda of independence and freedom.
And you also you wrote about this one, turn in your guns at the local church. I think this is in Chicago.
Yeah, that was last weekend. I mean, not yesterday, but a weekend before last. Yeah, they ask all the folks in Chicago to turn their guns in to 23 churches spread around the city, and they would receive $100 for turning in a gun, no questions asked. I thought it was interesting that the churches were the ones that were being used for this gun Turnian program. What happened to the separation of church and state on that issue?
Yeah, I mean, separation and church only applies if it fits a certain agenda. It's not consistent.
It only applies when the church or the people in the church are trying to affect the decision-making and the policy and so forth of whatever the political structure is at the time, not the other way around. But, yeah, this, you know, I couldn't resist. The criminals love those kind of programs. You know, first of all, a lot of the guns that they turned in are stolen. There's no questions asked, and the guns are destroyed. So think about it. You know, a criminal can steal some guns, and so his guns that he got cost nothing. And then he turns them in, and the taxpayers will pay him $100 for each gun. I mean, that's more than you'll get on the street a lot of times if you tried to sell them. Think of the guns that have been used in a crime. So he turns the gun in. The guns are destroyed. The police destroy the gun, so they just destroyed the evidence of a crime that had been committed at some point. You know, it just goes on and on. The lunacy of this, you know, guys will take a gun that doesn't work. It's some old gun that's been rusted through or has mechanical failure and hasn't been able to fire around for years, and turn two or three of those in, get a few hundred dollars from the cops, and then they can go out and buy a gun that really works. It's nuts, but you know, that's the kind of thought process that we get from these big government types.
Yeah, and you've another one from a few months ago about the left-right paradigm is a hoax. And it's something that, I mean, it's so obvious, but I think it needs to be brought up again, because so many people, but by the left-right paradigm is a hoax, a lot of people say there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats, but are you going further than that, and there's no difference at all between the left and the right, even beyond the political parties?
Well, yeah, if I had a drawing board for your listeners now, if they could somehow see me, I would try to illustrate it, see if I can try to paint a word picture here. Most people think of left and right as a straight line across. And on one side is the left, liberal, and the other side is the right, conservative, and then the moderate is in the middle. And they see everything as a straight line across. But that's not an accurate depiction of conservative, liberal, or left and right. A better picture would be to draw a circle. And on one side of the circle or an oval. And so take the right side of the oval from top to bottom, and that would be your right. Take the left side of the circle from top to bottom, and that would be the left. At the top of the circle, you know, you could write liberty. And then at the bottom of the circle, you could write tyranny. And the left and the right is always vacillating back and forth, up and down, actually, according to our word picture here, vacillating up and down between liberty and tyranny. With liberty, we are more and more free. As they go down toward tyranny, we are less and less free. Well, the left is doing the same thing. They're vacillating up and down all the time between liberty and tyranny. As the left goes up, they go toward liberty, and as they go down, they go toward tyranny. So left and right will meet. Oftentimes, they will meet at the point of liberty, or they will meet at the point of tyranny. Nowadays, more than not, they're both meeting at the point of tyranny. So it doesn't really matter whether we're being tyrannized by the left or we're being tyrannized by the right. It doesn't matter whether they call themselves a conservative or a liberal, a Republican or a Democrat.
You're talking about the Nolan chart, which I know I've seen it on a lot of libertarian websites, but I think that's definitely a lot better than the left versus right measurement. But I think even that's a little too simplistic. I sort of like to look at the political spectrum as like a globe. Because there's other factors. There's liberty versus tyranny. There's also globalism versus nationalism, elitism versus populism. There's so many different measurements. So I like to look at it more as a globe rather than the Nolan chart.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm picturing a globe or an oval. Same thing. Yeah, but the things you mentioned there, whether it's globalism or independence, elitism or populism, you're still at the point of liberty or at the point of tyranny, because globalism itself is tyrannical. Elitism is tyrannical. Issues that you could put in that on that side is a reference of liberty or tyranny, and whenever you've got the globalist agenda being enacted, we're talking about the loss of our liberties and the enactment of tyranny. You know, if you're talking about the elitist agenda being enacted, you're still talking about the loss of freedom and the enactment of tyranny. So no matter what it is, no matter what is the venue, no matter what's the platform, the stage that is being used, the result is the loss of liberty. So that's why I say that it doesn't matter whether it's left or right, Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal. It's either liberty or tyranny. And we until people can start in those terms and get rid of this left-right paradigm philosophy and just forget that line with the left on one side and the right on the other, and just see liberty at the top and tyranny at the bottom, and whether it's left or right, the way that they're taking us toward one pole or the other. And when people can start looking at it and visualizing it that way, then, you know, they don't care about party labels anymore and how you identify yourself and whether you say you're a Christian or not and whether you say you go to church or not. You know, the question is, do you believe in the principles of liberty, and are you going to help preserve the liberties of our people? So that is the perspective that most Americans just do not get.
You bring up the point that, I mean, globalism is tyranny. You have globalism and you have national sovereignty, and I think it's important for preserving liberty. You have to have national sovereignty, but a lot of libertarians, I think, are some of the open borders libertarians are part of the problem too, because they want both ways. They say they're for liberty, yet a lot of them oppose national sovereignty, such as being for open borders or unlimited free trade. I would give Gary Johnson, the libertarian candidate, as an example of that, because he's defended open borders and NAFTA.
Right, and I would agree with you on that, Robert. I think on that particular issue, a lot of our libertarian friends are misguided. We're not going to be able to preserve liberty without national sovereignty and state sovereignty, I might add. You know, it's absolutely critical to the preservation of freedom that we understand the importance of our nation's borders, protecting our borders, state sovereignty, protecting the autonomy of our states, etc. So I would concur with your analysis on that.
Because the way power works is power becomes more corrupt on a larger scale. It is easier to preserve liberty on a smaller scale. And like if you look at the local government, then you have the state, and then you have a country. And if you look on a global level, it would be almost impossible to defeat tyranny. That's why it's important. That's why it's so critical to have sovereignty on a national level and a local level.
Well, yeah, and you know, our job is not to dictate the internal affairs of other nations. I mean, that's one of the great fallacies of our foreign policy. We how many hundreds of thousands of lives have been lost, including American lives, over this interventionist foreign policy of our CIA and our State Department in Washington, D.C., which is all built on this misguided, unfortunate philosophy that somehow or another we, the United States of America, have a right to interject our will in the internal affairs of other nations. I mean, this is, I think, part and soul to what a genuine constitutionalist foreign policy is all about. And this is the thing that has separated Ron Paul, going back to our discussion on Ron, you know, this is what has separated Ron Paul from every other Republican presidential candidate over the last two election cycles. And he is the only one that has stood up at the Republican, on the Republican side of the aisle, some of our presidential candidates, and has articulated a constitutionalist foreign policy position. And that's why, you know, take your pick among the rest. It wouldn't have mattered which of the other Republican candidates would have surfaced as the nominee. When it comes to foreign policy, there's no difference between them. Ron Paul is the only candidate in the Republican Party for president that has articulated a constitutionalist foreign policy. And let's face it, a president is more influential in international affairs than he is in domestic affairs. And this is where, you know, the Republicans just have not ever been not chosen to deviate from this interventionist foreign policy.
So on the foreign policy, do you think Romney could end up being in some ways worse than Obama on that?
I think any Republican has the potential for being worse than a Democrat in terms of foreign policy because of the issues that we're talking about here.
Let's say Obama decided to go to war with Iran. A lot of the Republicans would back him on that.
Yeah, but the Democrats would not. And Obama's been, look, what's Obama done? Obama has been extending the war in the Middle East ever since he's been in office. And he, his own party is extremely upset with him about that. And he's gotten a lot of grief. And, you know, I don't know to stop what he's doing ultimately, because I personally think that the president is being influenced by other forces besides just the will of a political party. But if you put a Republican, well, look what George W. Bush got by with. You know, we invaded Iraq. We invaded a foreign nation, troops on the ground, without a declaration of war from Congress. You know, we've got troops on the ground in Afghanistan, declaration of war from Congress, or even a mark and reprisal bill, which Ron Paul tried to, you know, propose in 2001. You know, when it comes to war, nobody does it faster and better than the Republican Party. So, you know, that's why when it comes to international affairs and the taking of America to war, this is something that the Republican Party is just as expert at. Democrats will still do it. Obama's still doing it. But he's getting a lot of grief from his own party, and you know, the speed and the rapidity of this foreign policy warmongering isn't quite the same level as it is when the GOP controls the White House.
And you also made the point that the open borders proves that the war on terror is superficial.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. To think that we are fighting a war on terror and then our federal government to do absolutely nothing to secure the southern border of the United States is absolutely proof positive that the war on terror is as phony as a $3 bill.
Because that would be, you would think like right after 9/11 happened, that should have been the very first thing they did would be to shut down the border.
Well, sure. I mean, how many years does it take to enact a policy that would, for all intents and purposes, seal the border? I mean, you're never going to have it totally sealed, but you can do a real good job of it. Nothing's been done in that regard. In fact, look at what they're doing to the state of Arizona. You know, the federal government has done everything they can to stop the state of Arizona and Sheriff Tarpeyo in particular from enacting and enforcing immigration law there in that state. If they were really interested in doing something about illegal immigration, you know, you've got four states. You know, you got California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, which are the main landmass in which it's used by illegal aliens. And you've got one, Arizona, which is one of the biggest there, and you're doing everything you can to keep them from enacting immigration law. So that shows the absolute lunacy whenever we hear about this war on terror and how that we're trying to keep America safe from terrorists, and at the same time leaving the door wide open for virtually any terrorist to come across our country, into our country.
And that is the other thing about it is what about Republicans is you have these Republican congressmen who have been considered kind of immigration hawks, but they're completely silent about Romney on immigration.
Well, that goes back to the point that I was trying to make early in our discussion, Robert, and that is whenever you've got a GOP nominee or then president, the opposition goes to sleep. That's what you're saying. I mean, the GOP, the guys that would be the one that would try to enforce immigration laws, now you've got a nominee and a possible president who is extremely soft, always has been, on illegal immigration. So what are the, as you term them, hawks on this subject, what do? They go to sleep, say nothing. Whereas if you've got a soft Democrat, such as Obama, in office, why they keep shouting to the heavens, enacting legislation. You got Daniel Issa out there in California who's having all kinds of congressional hearings going on. You've got the impeachment of a Democrat attorney general over this fast and furious CIA FBI gun running operation, giving hundreds and hundreds of weapons to the drug cartels in Mexico that eventually is part of the murder of a Border Patrol agent. And now they're trying, but what happens when a Republican is in office and the same soft policy towards illegal immigration continues? Well, the opposition just goes to sleep.
We're out of time. I just want to plug your website. It's chuckbaldwinlive.com.
Thank you, Robert. That's right, chuckbaldwinlive.com.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for tonight, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.